They tripled the minimum wage to $7 million a month. But all those millions were not enough to buy 2 pounds of meat. That leads us to ask, can what happened to the price of food in Venezuela happen to the price of food in the U.S.?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1277th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Cusco who are tuned into the podcast as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, wherever you are and whoever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, MSN recently served up some news that caught my attention. The headline read, Venezuela triples wages, but still not enough to buy food. The writer went on to say that Venezuela's new minimum wage of 7 million bolivars per month is not enough to buy 2 pounds of meat. Shortly after reading this story, I enjoyed a leisurely meal with my lady at a nearby sit-down restaurant. The meal was very good, but nothing really special, just a couple of burgers and beers. What did make the meal special, to me at least, was the check that, with tip, approached $100. Yeah, $100 for a couple burgers and beers. It is becoming increasingly evident that more money is buying less food. And that leads us to ask, can what happened to the price of food in Venezuela happen to the price of food in the U.S.? Who better to ask than Dr. Jacob Manlove, who is Assistant Professor of Ag Economics at Arkansas State University. Dr. Jacob, welcome to the Food Chain.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Good to have you aboard. Well, I got to ask you, do you think what happened to the price of food in Venezuela can happen to the price of food in the U.S.?
Well, I certainly hope not, but there is some inflation coming in here with food in the U.S., and I do see some changes happening. Will it ever be to that extent? I don't believe so, but definitely seeing something we're not particularly used to with these increasing food prices here in the U.S.
Kind of going through the roof. I couldn't believe when they brought the check to the table, you know, had a nice meal. They were very delicious hamburgers, best in town, they say. But $100 for a couple of hamburgers. Wow, out of control. So as an Thomas Carlyle said that economist is the dismal science. Why would he say something like that?
Oh boy. Well, I think a lot of the times we get into the position that as an economist, a lot of the times we don't get to deliver the best news about what's actually happening kind of within our world economy and making that and putting it into the best light as possible. That's certainly a case for calling is very dismal. So
would it also have something to do with the fact that you take something that's pretty dry, like numbers, and plot them into charts that are kind of hard to follow, and in the effort of to try to make something that's pretty intangible tangible. So it's kind of like dry.
Absolutely.
Not very exciting like the today's news or anything.
Oh, certainly. A lot of the stuff we're seeing here is taking a lot of these very small, minute economic theories that just aren't very well known to a lot of people, and we put them in these charts, and it's not necessarily the easiest thing to understand, especially when we're talking about food and agriculture, which has such a dynamic system where it's got thousands and thousands of small pieces kind of playing into the big picture. So,
and there are a lot of pieces that play into the big picture, some of which we're going to talk about today, some very big forces that are acting upon the price of food. And that make looking at the price of food a kind of a very interesting subject when it gets right down to it. But you do take numbers that are actual data points, and you do plot them in a way that, you know, if you actually sit down and look at them, you can kind of see trends that are occurring. Is that a fair way of describing that?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so I've been looking at some of those graphs and charts and see some very interesting trends. And the trends that I see is that more money is buying less food. Is that a fair summation?
That is a very fair summation, especially during the current time we're in right now.
Well, let's take a quick look, if we can, at Venezuela. What do ag economists say happened to the price of food in Venezuela, where, you know, 7 million bolivars is insufficient to buy 2.2 pounds of meat? What happened?
Yeah, I think what we're really seeing there is just this feedback loop within the food system. It's we want to increase our minimum wage for our constituents within the country. And at the same time, when we're paying those constituents a larger wage, that's going to be a part of the cost that's going to go back into the food system. And when there's such a discrepancy between the two, what people are making and then how much our cost of producing these goods, and particularly within the food system, are, that discrepancy just continues to grow. And I think they're going to have a hard time kind of make those two meet, because they're much further along and much more departed than what we would typically see.
So they've kind of gone down the lane, down the road here, and they can't seem to get it turned around. Why can't they turn it around? Why can't they pull that together, or haven't been able to? I know that the United States is putting a lot of pressure on them, but that's not the only pressure that's being put on them, is it?
No, I mean, there's the internal pressure as well within the country, but they've essentially put it down in the left lane and with the hammer down, going as fast as they can. And it's hard to stop such momentum when you're already on such a trajectory. And when you can attack one side, or not really attack, but necessarily give aid to one side. So you're talking about the demand of the consumer side. We're going to raise our minimum wage so that we can try to correct it in that direction. And then we see a correction on the other side. So it's kind of a bounce back of overcorrections, where the two sides, both supply and demand, never really meet up in terms of what they have to offer and being able to afford what you're trying to go out and get.
So the money's there. They're pouring 7 million bolivars a month. That's the minimum wage, you know, and if you have a good job, you're making much more than 7 million bolivars a month. But if you take those 7 million bolivars down to the grocery store and try to buy 2.2 pounds of meat, you don't have enough money. Now, you know, looking at the situation from the grocer's perspective, why don't you take 7 million bolivars for your 2.2 pounds of meat? It seems like a lot of money.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the big issue is that every time that we increase this minimum wage, that's going to come back somewhere along the entire chain, whether it be the distribution of the food or whether it be at that grocer itself. Somewhere along that supply chain of that entire food process, someone's going to have to absorb that. And so what do you do when you have an increased cost? You have to raise your prices. And so, again, there becomes that imbalance between 7 million seems like a very large number, but when we're comparing to where we were and the increase on both sides, making those two things match and be able to kind of come to an equilibrium in the market is going to be difficult.
And there is this wonderful equilibrium to pricing things, is there not? Equilibrium theory of pricing, where
absolutely
supply and demand. Would you give us a thumbnail about that?
Yeah, so kind of one of the catchphrases I've heard all throughout my academic career is that economists tend to worship where supply and demand intersect, where the amount of demand for a product, what a consumer can pay, and a lot of that's going to be based on their budget, and their budget's going to be based off of their income, and a few other constraints as well, matches up with the supply side. What can a business or a grocer, with this example, actually offer a product, still meet their bottom line? And so where do those two factors, the two forces, supply and demand, both equal and kind of set a point where both the producer and the consumer are in an understanding and they're getting the maximum utility, the maximum amount of good out of those particular products from both sides?
Then something seems to have gone completely haywire with the equilibrium theory of supply and demand in Venezuela. And it seems to be happening on two sides of the equation. First of all, It seems that the real price or the real value of food is going up and up and up because food is becoming harder and harder and harder to get. Is that fair?
I think it's a fair statement, yes.
And then on the other side of the equation, money is losing its value. And
absolutely.
The more money that the government offers its workers, the less value that money has. That's another. Is that fair too?
Absolutely. Certainly, Jim.
So then we have a real problem with supply and demand because nobody really knows what the value of money is anymore. And whereas food has a real value and it's really searching for what to sell itself for. I mean, if you're a grocer, how do you come to grips with the fact that 7 million bolivars won't buy 2.2 pounds of meat? What do you sell your stuff? What do you sell your food for when the money is no longer money?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, that becomes part of the issue when you have, like you have Venezuela that has hyperinflation. It's that I can sell these foods for, say, 7 million on a Tuesday, and the inflation when it's, I believe in Venezuela, around 26-27% right now, 3 days later, you've lost money once the food actually makes it all the way through the entire supply chain to your grocer and then to the consumer. There's a constant change in prices that have to be accounted for, and so when you make those constant changes, one of the things we say in economics is that supply and demand really take some time
to adjust,
actually come to the equilibrium. And so when you have such a rapid amount of change, finding that equilibrium becomes that much more difficult.
Now, looking into history, we've seen this happen a number of times, most notably in Nazi Germany, when the value of the Deutschmark went through the roof. And of course, we all learned in school about how you had to have a wheelbarrow full of money to buy a loaf of bread. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be the case now in Venezuela.
Absolutely.
And these both cases seem to be a case in which the government ended up just printing money. Whenever mm-hmm. they decided they needed money, they just printed.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if they needed more money, they would print it. And then that's kind of what led to that hyperinflation. And then once you see such large hyperinflation, one of the other kind of stories out of Venezuela with that is that there's some black market good selling and some illegal economic activities, because it's almost as if you have a government-ran market and the market on the outside is almost behaving more like a true competitive market than what you actually get with the government-sponsored market with the inflation and the increase in wages that are going along with it.
So the real market then is the black market. Well, this is where we're headed today, folks. What happened to the price of food in Venezuela? And can what happened to the price of food in Venezuela happen here in the United States? It seems to me like prices of food are going through the roof. $100 for a couple hamburgers and a couple beers? My goodness sakes, out of control. That's the subject we have on the table today with Dr. Jacob Manlove, who's an assistant professor of ag economics at Arkansas State University. And so when we come back, we're going to start looking at food prices here in the United States and what is affecting them. Do stay tuned.
let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back, folks. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What with Dr. Jacob Manlove, Assistant Professor of Ag Economics at Arkansas State University, talking about the price of food. Do your students ask you, Dr. Manlove, what's going on with the price of food?
We've had some discussions about it, certainly. I do teach a marketing course and then commodities as well, and they see it. They see it happen, and as a college student, you can even imagine with their budget being even a little
sure.
bit, quite a bit less than what we would normally be out in once we have our careers. And
peanut butter and jelly, I remember it well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Peanut butter and jelly and ramen. So
ramen's the latest thing, yeah. Let's start with one side of the equation, which is, to me, there's two sides, I think. One is the side of what it costs to produce food, because what it costs really is a prime determinant of what that the value of the food must be. Because if you're producing it for, if you're selling it for more than it costs, you're losing money and you're not going to be in business for a while. So what does it cost to make food? And the other thing is the value of money itself. So those are the two elements I see. Any other elements working in there, Dr. Manlove? Am I missing anything?
We also have some things in terms of how we use what we produce in the United States in terms of exports and exports and imports for
right.
foods, in terms of feedstocks and some of the issues we've seen with larger than expected demand from countries like China as mm-hmm. they've kind of built back their agricultural stocks in terms of livestock. So
that certainly has an impact on demand, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, yep. let's look to the price of food and see if we can't come to grips with it. First thing we learned from some of the graphs that you have provided me is that there's good news in that the rate of increase is falling, but the prices are still going up. So I guess the good news is tempered by that, right?
In some ways, yes. And I think the kind of important thing to remember in terms of what reactions we see on these charts we publish and then what we see with actually in the consumer marketplace is going to be, there's going to be a delay. You have to think about the entire food chain from the time we go to the, from farm to table, essentially. We go from production, processing, we go to marketing, packaging, and the entire step of the way. So it's going to take some time to get to the consumers. So I think there is some good news in that we've seen a little bit of a top out in terms of what we think are going to happen with prices, but I still think a little bit further down the road, some of those things we've seen are going to definitely continue to have an impact later on.
Oh, good. It seems like looking at the charts, the big hit we took in the price of food when prices of food actually went up quickest was back in 2008 with the collapse of the economy due to the housing bubble. And we recovered a bit from then, but then we ended up with COVID. And COVID has had pretty big impact on the price of food for a number of reasons, but the biggest one might well have been the availability of labor.
Yeah, absolutely. I would make the argument potentially that COVID has kind of been our iceberg to our Titanic of agriculture. It exposed some of the
issues.
That's
a pretty good expression. Not too nice, though, but pretty expressive. So we hit the iceberg, and now we're on the Titanic. And
It kind of exposed some things that we didn't necessarily see when we first hit COVID. So I think we can attribute a lot of this to the COVID pandemic, and not necessarily that COVID was the main driving factor behind it, but that COVID created this less than ideal marketplace, less than ideal series of situations that kind of happened sequentially that brought about a few of those other things within the entire system that kind of exposed them, if that's maybe the correct or incorrect word to use for that, but made it aware that we see some other issues that we should probably address.
Such as?
For the first one is that how do we trade products? And so this is a product that is, this is not just for agriculture. This is for, we've seen shortages, of course, in lumber. We've seen shortages in microprocessing and technology. And how do we trade with other countries? What are the different protocols for ports? And so I know that within the Pacific Northwest, it's around a two-week travel time to the other side of the country in terms of trading goods. And we've seen boats and container ships as well that have set in the Gulf or in the ocean for up to 10 days, just because we don't have the staff available to load and unload these vessels. And that, again, is kind of putting back in pressure in on the supply chain. And the reason we don't have those people to work those ports is really, at that time, it came down to COVID, and whether people were testing positive for COVID or just the protocols surrounding that is one person's exposed, and then we have an entire 20 extra people that are out because of potential exposure, and that's had an impact as well.
You know, that calls to mind Michael Olson's second law of the food chain. The farther we go from the source of our food, the less control we have over that food. I guess that's pretty well sums it up. Nobody to empty the ships, then we're a long way from that food when it gets right down to it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so, and that's something we don't tend to think about either, but it has a big impact on food when you can't get it to, and there you go. And of course, that keys in with labor, but labor factors in so many other places. For example, the processing of meat is very labor intensive. And when COVID hit, boy, it was hard to find meat.
Yeah, absolutely. We had a very large shortage, and not necessarily the supply of the raw product going in, but being able to process it into a way that was acceptable for a consumer to buy. We had to make a shift from packaging things in large wholesale environments where we were to schools, and you know, we can think milk cartons, or you could think larger things like ribs and stuff that would go to restaurants. We're not buying those for at-home consumption. And so now we can process the meat, but now our packaging has to completely change as well. So all of the steps along the entire process contributed.
So COVID had a stumbling and had a pretty big impact on the price of food. There's just no two ways about it. Do we see any moderation in the impact of COVID, or are we still fumbling about as we were in the beginning?
I'd like to think there's been some progress. I think that some of the things that we're experiencing now, today, like I said, they came from COVID, but they're not necessarily 100% COVID related. So we can talk about, I'm sure we'll talk about inflation. You know, was COVID part of that issue? I think some economists would argue yes. Some would argue no, and how that impacted food as well.
I'd like to back up with that thought. Science, economics is a science, and they say science is real. So do all economists agree on what's going on, or is there disagreement between economists?
There's certainly disagreement, and I think we can even trace that back to you know, looking through the history of economics, there were completely different schools of thoughts. There was the idea of Keynesian economics versus Marx. I mean, that's developed in essentially the same time period, very close to one another, and very different ideas. And we even see that today. And what necessarily is it inflation causing it? Some economists do agree. And so I think one of the things we see in terms of a disagreement between economists in terms of the inflation is that, is this inflation that we're seeing right now a transitory inflation, or is it permanent? And so that, I think, is where we see the biggest disagreement in terms of economists on how that is particularly affecting food prices.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and pick that up down the line, because that's a big difference right there, because one says, it's got to go away, and the other was saying, it's going to end up like Venezuela.
Yeah.
There you go. So, but the impact of labor has had a huge impact on the price of food. And you brought up transportation, too, because what? It takes a long time to get food from one side of the country to the other. And there's another expense that's being factored into transportation, and that is the price of fuel, which has gone through the roof. Here in California, we're close to $5-6 a gallon for gas. And much of our food travels on gasoline or diesel.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you see happening with respect to the price of fuel and transportation factoring into the price of food?
Yeah, absolutely. So I kind of think about food movement in terms of transportation in kind of two categories. So you have the raw products, specifically kind of made out of the Midwest, corn, soybeans, rice throughout the Delta region as well. A lot of those are going to travel a majority of their life as a commodity on a river or on some kind of a rail system. And so that's going to have a slightly lower cost. But when you think about how we get food to a consumer, that's processed food. That's food that has to be refrigerated and moved quickly. And that's what we rely on the trucking system within the United States for. And what does that trucking system rely on? It's fuel. It has to have oil to operate. And if those prices go up and we see the cost of moving a good, even 30, 45 miles, that's going to have an impact on the actual cost of the good itself. So we saw maybe in the beginning of this, some of these companies may have hedged their positions on oil prices and were able to sustain themselves a couple of months. But now that we've seen kind of a steady increase in these prices, less of these businesses have hedged that risk. And now they're starting to have to see how that's affecting their bottom line. And these companies aren't just going to let it affect their bottom line. Eventually, it's going to have to come work its way back into the food system. And we're going to see those prices at the food retail stores. And like you saw with the burgers, they're going to eventually have to come back, and a consumer is going to have to pay more for it, because not every piece of that price of the transportation piece is going to be absorbed by the company that is actually distributing or producing this food.
Got to pass the costs along, or you end up losing money and go out of business. So
absolutely,
you just have to pass those prices along, and gasoline being a big part of it. Now, with the change of administrations, we've seen a whole new shift in the policy with respect to petrochemical energy. Do you see any hope in electric trucks?
I think there is maybe for distribution, but another piece that I don't think we always think about in terms of oil, I want to kind of circle back to this here, is that there's a lot of usages of oil on the actual production side. So when you think about producing row crop corn or whatever you're producing, soybeans or rice, there's tractors, and those tractors run on oil. And so again, we can trace that entire increase in cost all the way back to the very beginning when we put that in the ground as a seed. Because if that producer is going to have to pay more for their production, their cost per acre is going to go up for harvest, for application of fertilizers and other materials. They're going to then pass that on to the processor that's going to continue to pass its way along the line. So one thing I don't think we always remember is that, yeah, we have to transport goods, but there is also the usage of these oils, heavy usage of these oils and such, on a lot of these farms that are going to have an impact.
And that brings up another issue with respect to the cost of producing food. And it's something we see quite readily by looking at the environmental movement, which points to agriculture as being a great polluter and stating that there is a need to get rid of you know, the carbon in the atmosphere. And, of course, the hydrocarbon energy is a big part of that. But so are cattle. Mm-hmm. And so that I see a tremendous effort by the environmental community to force agriculture to do things differently, which I suspect will mean it's going to cost more to grow food just by virtue of those environmental concerns. Have you given that any consideration?
I mean, I definitely think it will have an impact. I mean, as we've seen in some literature, just it's pretty fairly well established that the more barriers you have to entry into a marketplace, the more barriers you have to actually producing your good, it adds cost. All of those regulations can add a cost if they're not implemented in a way that is easy to do so. And some of these things that are being proposed from a farmer's perspective, I'm not certain that the technology is there at this point in time to actually implement them in an easy way. So we're asking essentially our producers to make a jump that we wouldn't expect for 10 or 15 years. Are we moving in the right direction? Absolutely. We're making things, they're getting better. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I don't think that we can expect a jump that large from an industry that, even though it is a focus of a lot of environmental concern, it's really not what I would consider the low-hanging fruit in the United States in terms of what we should go after and we should really be concerned about from an environmental perspective.
You know, my idea of the ideal low-hanging fruit is China, which produces more more pollution than any other place in the world. And I just think if we really were serious about this, we would stop buying so much made in China. Because what I have seen out here in California is we've essentially chased away much of our agriculture to other countries because we demand that they be so clean that they can't exist here, especially in California. And so much of Californian agriculture simply moved across the border or across the oceans or whatnot. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know. But and speaking of China, they've had a huge impact on the price of food here in the United States. Why?
Yeah, absolutely. So when you think about some of our products that we grow in terms of what our main exports from the U.S. are, soybeans being one of the large ones, also corn, those are primarily a lot of times used for feedstock. And so that will be some kind of a ration between certain proteins that we want to feed our animals and for our livestock. And so in 2019, China's their hog market or their hog livestock that they had, they've started to rebuild that entire program.
I'd like to pick that up when we get back from this quick break here, because it's hugely significant as to what happened to China's hog market and their need for our feed. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What with Dr. Jacob Manlove, Assistant Professor of Ag Economics, Arkansas State University, and you right back.
You can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in MetroFarm, the guide to growing in or near the city for the city.
Polyface Farms, Joel Salatin.
Few how-to books could be more appropriate for our times than MetroFarm, a truly comprehensive manual. MetroFarm makes the whole embedded food system doable. It's a must-read.
USDA Director Bud Kerr.
Big book. Metro Farm describes the agronomic, economic, and managerial concepts required to generate substantial profits from agricultural locales near metropolitan areas.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning Metro Farm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
Hi, folks. How many of you out there love to garden? Wouldn't it be nice to grow some of your own food? Or maybe a flower garden would brighten your day. Well, now you can have the pleasures of gardening without all that effort. You don't need a tractor. You don't need a rototiller. All you need is the Knox Garden Box, a heavily constructed, portable, elevated garden on legs that can virtually change the way you've gardened in the past. The Knox Garden Box can be set up anywhere. Yes, you can place it right on concrete. For those with bad backs, you've got critters and gophers, no space or maybe no dirt. With the Knox Garden Box, the therapy of garden is now the prescription for good mental health. The way to find your fabulous Knox Garden Box is by logging on to knoxgardenbox.com. That's K-N-O-X, gardenbox.com. Or by calling 831-461-9430.
History buffs. This tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place while the USS Dale steamed through the Bering Sea, January 1943.
We took some terrible waves up there. One time a big groundswell rolled us over so far I thought we'd never make it back. I was on the lee deck when the ship went over into that roll. Luckily, I was able to grab onto a bulkhead handrail, and when the Dale went over, my feet left the deck. I hung there with nothing between my feet and the ocean but air. I was scared. She went over on her beam, paused for a minute, then she shuddered and shook because one of her propellers was out of the water and thrashing air. Slowly, very slowly, she rolled back toward the vertical, and my feet found the deck again. That wave scared the devil out of me.
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com. talesfromatincan.com.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, I think it was called African Swine Flu, but it swept through China and devastated China's hog market. Now, ladies and gentlemen, China loves pork. It's their main source of protein, and they eat a lot of it. And when this swine flu swept through China, it simply devastated the industry. And now I think they have the swine flu under control, and they're rebuilding their herd, which means they need a lot of food. And where do they get that food, Dr. Manlove?
Yes, absolutely. So as they rebuild that herd, they need this feedstock. And one of China's big appetite is for soybeans. And that soybean production comes from both the U.S. and Brazil. And that's one way we kind of see this Chinese hog market having an impact even on consumer prices in the U.S. is that as they buy more product from the U.S., and Brazil didn't have the greatest weather conditions, so their stocks of soybeans weren't as great as we would have necessarily expected or hoped. And so it's putting a lot of pressure on the U.S. price of soybeans because they need that to feed out this livestock population that they're rebuilding within China.
And since they have all their money, they have money to buy the soybeans.
Yes, absolutely. And then when they buy the soybeans, they drive the price of the soybeans up in the U.S. And then we have cattle producers. We have poultry producers that are using these in their feed rations in the U.S. that are kind of bullish on these prices now, that think that their input prices are going to be going up, and they have been. And now we see that kind of translate to increased prices in our consumer products.
So in essence, we have all of these forces that have been acting to increase the costs of production, which means, inevitably, that the value of food goes up. It becomes more expensive, whatever the value of your money is, correct? There's just no two ways about it. It costs more, yeah, to cost more to produce. It's going to cost more on the grocery shelves. So let's turn our thoughts then to the value of money and what impacts. So if we were buying and selling in gold, it would be pretty easy to do, but we don't do that anymore, do we?
Absolutely not. So we have to think about what is our value of this money that we're spending on these products actually worth, and we have this constant change, and so that, again, feeds back into these prices.
So we talked about there's two basic schools of thought with respect to monetary policy. What were they again? Keynesian.
Keynesian and Marx, that was kind of my example in how we can develop sort of competing ideas in terms of theory and what's best for the economy, okay, kind of coming about the same time and seeing that same kind of argument now with the inflation that we currently have, as mm-hmm, some economists see it as a transitory inflation that's not even tracked by the Fed, that they believe is only temporary. And then we see some economists making an argument that maybe it's a little bit more permanent of an inflation, and we should watch it a little bit more closely.
So one is expansionary in that, you know, we're growing things. We're pouring money into the economy to make things grow. And the other is saying, whoa, slow down, because if we keep pouring money into the economy, we end up in a situation of rapid growth, rapid inflation, and that appears to be where we are. But in relation to normal times, if there is such a thing anymore, are we really going through inflationary times? Or what do you think? Is it just a temporary thing caused by COVID?
I've seen arguments on both. Personal opinion, so no one hold me to this, but I do think that some of this inflation we're seeing is going to be permanent, but I think we have to be careful how we state it. I've seen those stated as all of this inflation we see right now is 100% permanent, and I've seen some say that it's 100% transitory. And the thing is, as an economist, we don't necessarily know. We don't really have a 100% answer. We can give our best, most educated guess. Mm-hmm. I hate to call it that, but I mean, that's essentially what it is. How do we look at other factors that are influencing this and saying, do we see it actually lasting or do we not? And so in the last few weeks, we've seen a little bit of relief. And so maybe that top portion of what we've seen so far was transitory, and maybe there's more transitory inflation to kind of reveal itself later on down the road. But at this point in time, I don't think we can really make a fair statement that's, well, nothing will be accurate if we make one now. And the prediction is best thing, wait and see.
Okay, there you go. And let's go back to the notion that this is a science. We're working with real numbers, and you are working with real numbers, correct?
Yes, sir.
And you plug these real numbers into your computer that makes a graph, and we can look at them. But there are so many other things that we can't see yet. And I think back to 2008, in which we had the collapse of the housing market and the collapse of the entire economy. Boom. And we didn't see that coming. Or at least not everybody saw it coming. Some did. And then now we are in 2019. We did not see COVID coming. And all of a sudden, here we are in COVID, and we can't go to work. And so to compensate for these situations, the government becomes expansionary, correct? Starts pouring pouring in the money. And that's what we've seen. We have very, very low interest rates now, almost zero. They're almost paying us to borrow money.
Yep.
And that's very expansionary. So that's pouring money into the economy like crazy. And another thing is that the government is spending money like crazy, correct?
Correct.
So that's a very expansionary mode. And what happens? How do we know if we hit that tripping point where we just go into uncontrolled inflation, as has Venezuela, where you get into this endless feedback loop where you have to keep raising the minimum wage every couple of days to keep up?
Yeah, absolutely. I've seen on this, as I know there's been discussions of another stimulus check in the future, and I've seen some arguments from economists that we're getting too expansionary. We are forcefully making people use a discretionary income that they don't have, but we're giving them, and it's kind of increased.
Now, where do we get creating. That? Where do we get that money to give them?
That's a good question. Coming essentially, there's no backing behind that. Essentially, that we can say that it's devaluing the current money, but putting more paper money into the economy.
So we don't have any money. We're just printing the printing the money, and I guess I often think of it as we're stealing money from our grandchildren by printing money today that we don't have.
Yeah. Sometime down the line, someone is going to have a responsibility for the money that we have that we are putting out into circulation. And whether it be that our grandchildren are plagued with super high inflation, or they have a large amount of government debt that eventually somehow we're going to have to tackle in some sort of a way, because we can't continue to add onto this forever. So
yeah. Now, do governments, it would seem to me like it would be a great temptation for government to say the way out of this is just to print more money and inflate our way out of this debt. Does that make any sense? I mean,
I see the argument in terms of making sense. I don't know what is the sustainability of that. I think that kind of goes back to Venezuela, where I think maybe that was their approach for a while. We print our way out of this. We work on one side of the economy, supply, then we work on demand, and we try to get things to balance out to come to that equilibrium. Where do we come to the point where we say we've pushed one too far, we can't bring it back now, we've We've done so much, we've increased too far. How do we actually get it to come back the other way? And that's one of the arguments I've seen when we talk about the inflation right now, is that for those that are arguing that is transitory, it's only a temporary inflation. If it's transitory, we need to see some kind of transitory deflation after to actually make the economy come back to this stable equilibrium in terms of what we're spending and what we're saving and what we're receiving in terms of payments. And so,
yeah, we need to see cheaper food, right? We need to see the price of food going down.
We need to see things move the other direction.
But we're not seeing that.
We're not.
We're not seeing that at all. Okay. So it seems like this is a thin ice kind of situation that we're in. If what happens if we were to put the brakes on right now? As we're in this very tough economy, in some respects, going back to the $100 hamburger, the restaurant is having a terrible time finding employees. It can't find people to work, and even with the tips that they are charging, you can't find people to work. And one of the reasons they're not getting people to work is because the government is paying people not to work. And so why the heck would you want to bust tables and wash dishes when you can sit on your duff and watch TV and get paid for it?
Yeah, that's a great point. So I'm kind of going back to the supply demand. When we talk about that, a lot of this demand we're seeing for food, some of it is artificial demand that we're just creating by providing payments. And so when we think about eating out, there was a huge shift at the beginning of the pandemic that more people ate at home, and that was really the driving story of what was happening to our food, and that we had to package differently, had to prepare it differently to eat at home. And now that the economy has started to open back up a little bit, we've seen that more people are starting to eat out. And so that's having this artificial kind of created demand within that particular sector. And we've also seen that as people's incomes grow, their demand for products like beef, like chicken, they become much higher as your income rises. We just expect that. They're normal goods. We have higher income. We're willing to pay more for quality. So is it sustainable? I don't think so, though.
So I don't think anybody really thinks it's sustainable, the situation we're in. But how do we go about getting control again? Now, if you were put in charge of Venezuela, I just did. I put you in charge of Venezuela because you're an ag economist and the price of food is out of control. So, Dr. Jacob Manlove, assistant professor of ag economics at Arkansas State, how do you turn Venezuela around? What do you do to put a brake? Put the brakes on that runaway feed loop that is Venezuela.
So I think the biggest thing is that when we think about kind of our requirements for what makes a competitive market, and one of those that comes to my mind when I think about Venezuela and the way that they have kind of handled the government internal relations in terms of the inflation is that you have to have perfect information. I don't see that within Venezuela. There's a lot of decisions that are being made that are not necessarily involving all the parties that should be involved. And so I think the first thing that Venezuela needs to do is, and this is really based on how well a country is able to share communications and share information, is we need to be more transparent with what's actually happening. And so I think that's the biggest issue, is we need to be transparent here in the U.S. as well. What actually is happening? What are the effects of these payments that we're doing? What are the effects of the cost of labor within different markets? And so that would be my first suggestion, is how do we make it transparent so that we understand where we are, rather than it be this week we increase this payment and then the next week we see another increase and we don't know necessarily why everything is happening.
You need the data points.
Absolutely.
And the next thing you would do?
Oh, next thing I would do. we got the perfect competition. So I'm assuming we have this. We want the information, and then
Make it competitive. You have to compete.
Yeah, I mean, one of the issues with, I think, with Venezuela that we need to learn about and try to study a little bit more is what is their relationship in terms of how they handle their entire supply chain? And what are they doing in terms of, have we driven too many markets out because of this inflation that we've had previously? So, like we've said, if a business has inflation and they can't pass all those costs along, their option is to shut down. And so have we seen in Venezuela a less competitive market because people have been artificially driven out of the market due to what we've been trying to do to combat the inflation itself in the beginning?
Well, let us hope that the good folks in Venezuela have been tuned in today and that they hear some common sense from Dr. Jacob Manlove and they decide, well, maybe that's exactly what we need to do, is bring Dr. Jacob Manlove down here and he can straighten things out, because it sounds like what you have to offer might just do that. You have to open up your economy. You have to be telling the truth. You have to be competitive, and you have to have the will to win. Dr. Jacob Manlove, thank you so much for joining us on The Food Chain. Folks, remember Michael Olson's third law of the food chain: cheap food isn't. Thank you, Dr. Jacob.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.